Welcome to a brand new edition of Problematic Women. I'm Virginia Allen.
And I'm Brenda Hafera.
We are so glad to be with you all today in studio. Our good friend and co-host, Kristen Eichhammer, is out today, but we are going to be joined a little bit later today by our friend Sarah Parshall Perry to dive into some Supreme Court news. But I wanted to do a follow-up this week on the Kate Middleton news. Of course, we 2 weeks ago talked, Brenda, on the show a little bit about the mystery of where is Kate Middleton, and everyone was wondering, and she'd published that picture on the UK's Mother's Day and had then confirmed that it had been edited. Now, of course, we know she has come out and said that she has cancer and is going through treatment and process with that. Have you been following the whole journey and saga and all the press coverage, Brenda, of Kate Middleton?
I wouldn't say I was following it, but it's hard to not have been aware of it. Yep. It was all over the headlines, and there was so much speculation about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and really heartbreaking, of course. I mean, anytime anyone has cancer, but you think of a mom with three young kids, and of course, someone who's under the pressure that she's under and has all eyes on her. And I think it was very heartfelt, the video that she filmed, and it felt very raw and it felt very honest. And I think people really appreciated that. And you're seeing right now just a really beautiful response, I think, from people all over the world who are praying for Kate Middleton and for her full recovery. And we don't know the details. She was, I think, intentionally vague, as she has every right to be in that announcement. We don't know what type of cancer she has. There's been all of these news hits that I've seen of, you know, doctors kind of trying to infer, you know, what kind of cancer she might have. I'm like, well, I think the public has enough information right now. We know what she's going through in part, and that's enough.
Right. I think we need to stop with the speculating and the gossip, because, I mean, she came out and said that she was having abdominal surgery, and it was clear that she was struggling with her health, right? She was forthright and truthful about that. And then there was all this gossip about her husband having an affair. And that's just, to me, seemed very mean-spirited, mm-hmm. of maybe a little sensitivity if she said she was having a health problem, and just respect that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was so bizarre to see her totally disappear, even though the palace had said she is disappearing, gave a heads up for about 3 months. It's the whole thing seems so bizarre. But I'm like, okay, this explanation makes it, it's maybe one of the hardest explanations. And it's also like, oh, yes, this makes sense. Mm-hmm. Fully makes sense. So our thoughts, our prayers are with Kate Middleton for her full recovery. And as she said in her video, which I thought was so beautiful, is it's such a reminder of just the struggle of cancer. And, you know, she said she's thinking about all the people that walk through this journey. And, you know, I have friends, I have family that have walked through that journey, and it really, really is a hard one. So we continue to keep Kate Middleton, her family, in our thoughts and prayers. But today we have a lot of ground to cover, and in many ways, some really significant ground, talking about some big topics today. First, Brenda and I are going to be diving in and discussing the boy crisis and manhood crisis in America. And, you know, to solve this issue, it's simple in theory, but it's a little bit harder in practice. And then EV Magazine reports that there are four categories of female attractiveness. But why are we as a culture so obsessed with this topic? And what does it say about us? And the Supreme Court heard oral arguments finally for the mifepristone abortion pill case. Sarah Parshall Perry is going to join us here in a few minutes to break that down further and explain what we heard from the justices and what we can infer about how they might rule. And as always, we'll be crowning our Problematic Woman of the Week.
Each week on Problematic Women, we sort through the news to find stories that are of particular interest to conservative-leaning or problematic women. those whose views and opinions are often excluded by those on the so-called feminist left.
If you are a problematic woman, or maybe just someone who supports strong, independent women, please consider taking a minute to leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you like to listen. And also, share it with your friends. Encourage other people to subscribe to the show. That makes a huge difference.
All right, let's get to it.
In 1984, women began asking the question, where have all the good men gone? And where are all the gods? Where's the streetwise Hercules to fight the rising odds? Well, a little shout out there to Bonnie Tyler. The song hit a nerve way back in 1984 in the movie Footloose, and it continues to hit a huge nerve today. And we find ourselves, in many ways, asking the same question, where are all the good men? So I would define what we call as the boy crisis as a crisis of, in many ways, of males never being raised to a position of being men, never being challenged or called to reach their potential, but instead essentially staying boys. But I'm not the expert on this issue. Brenda, you are, and you have just written a very extensive report on what we call the boy crisis. So I want to ask you, how would you define the boy crisis?
So the crisis of boys and men is really about answering a question. It's about answering the question, how and why are boys and men in America and in many ways throughout the world struggling to flourish? Mm. And so this crisis is mental, physical, economic, academic, and spiritual. So just to give some statistics to lay it out, in the United States, the second leading cause of death for men under 45 is suicide. Mm. The IQs of boys on average are dropping. In 2020, only 25% of men ages 17 to 24 qualified for military service, and most were disqualified for mental and physical health reasons, for problems with drugs, for being overweight, or a combination of those factors. So they're struggling physically. And academically, compared to 41% of girls, which is not good, only 20% of boys are at least proficient in writing. And men now only earn approximately 40% of college degrees at a time where having a college education really does mean having financial security because of economic shifts. And then finally, over 7 million men between the ages of 25 and 55 have checked out of the workforce entirely. So it really does hit at all stages of life, of boys, of students, of men.
Wow. You mentioned the fall in IQ. I thought that was kind of bizarre and something that I was just fascinated in your report. Do we know why IQ has fallen for men in recent years?
Yes. So there are a lot of contributing factors to the boy crisis, which you can imagine, given the breadth of it, that would be the case. But the number one driver, the primary driver, is a lack of fathers and a lack of time with dads. So studies have indicated, and particularly the boy crisis by Warren Farrell and John Gray is a great resource for this, that whether or not dad is present impacts school achievement, verbal intelligence and quantitative abilities, school dropouts, employment, suicide, drugs, homelessness, bullying, victimization, violent crime, rape, poverty and mobility, hypertension, trust, and empathy. Mm. So there's this assumption that the physical and the mental don't interact with each other, which is part of our modern world. We're a very psychological society, and that is just not the case. So the physical and the mental are tied together. So to give another example, in addition to the IQ example, telomere length in early life predicts lifespan. And children with father loss already have, by age 9, telomeres that are 14% shorter. And this is 40% greater of a loss for boys compared to girls. So it is so deep, so important to have a father in the presence of a child that it even impacts their lifespan.
Well, and it seems like where we found ourselves is in a bit of a vicious cycle, right? Because the easy solution, the quick fix is, great, we just need fathers. Like, we'll just put fathers in the home and then it improves. And it's like, yes, that's true. We put fathers in the home, things can improve. But as we know, it's really hard to restart that trend, right? Like, if we were just looking at the numbers and people just went by the data, it's obvious. It's like, oh, I'll do much better. My kids will do much better in life if I'm just present and a good father. And like, people would just follow the data and be like, oh, yes, this is mm-hmm. the way to fix all these social issues. But it's not that simple. And it's really hard when you have a generation that has been raised without a father to then know, how can I be a good father when it hasn't been modeled? They haven't seen it modeled.
Right. Having good models is so incredibly important for human beings. We are embodied, mimetic creatures, and talking about these things theoretically often just doesn't cut it. You mm-hmm. need to see it actually lived out. And I think it's very important what you said about this can turn into a cycle. So 62% of millennials were raised by both parents, and that's compared to 71% of Gen Xers, 85% of baby boomers, and 87% of silence.
So it's just a downward trend.
It is downward trend. It does seem like divorce is actually going down at this point, which is good news. But I think what happens is when you have breakdown of the family in one generation, that can lead to a lack of family formation in the next generation. Mm-hmm. And we've seen there's an interesting study called like the 30-year impact of divorce. And the idea that kids are just impacted by divorce when it happens is not true, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So adults, because they don't have that model of a good marriage, adults whose parents divorce can sometimes have a negative view of marriage. They don't know what to look for in a spouse, and they don't know how to work through conflict in a healthy manner sometimes. They need that model, and they need an understanding of what is the purpose of marriage, yeah. which as a society, I feel like we have definitely got away from that, of the purpose of marriage is for the good of the spouses and to create a loving environment to raise children. So it's simple to say that what we need is fathers, that's true, but we also need to say that what we really need is intact marriages because it's very practically challenging for a father to be involved with his kids outside of marriage to the extent that it's necessary. Kids need a lot of time with their parents. And if you're not living with mom, it's very hard to get that amount of time. And when parents are not married before having children, that is a very unstable. So people who just live together, that's not as stable of a situation as people who get married. For example, when unmarried couples live together, when their child is born, by the child's third birthday, 40% of those kids will have no regular contact with their dad for the next 2 years between ages 3 and 5.
Wow.
So it's really, we need to have a conversation about fathers within the context of marriage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In your research, did you come across any examples of societies, whether a nation today or historically, that have kind of been able to turn this trend around? Because it is discouraging. And it's like, all right, we know that the answer is these intact, beautiful, full families, but how do we get back to that place? And I know that even here at the Heritage Foundation with your research, and you know, there's so many organizations that this is their sole mission, is to further the family. I'm thinking of great organizations like the Family Research Council, and I mean, there's just great groups that are doing the work, and there's a lot of change that we still need to see in America to actually rebuild a family structure that allows children to thrive, that allows men to have those higher IQs, to have higher job placements, to graduate, to stop committing suicide, to see all those trends go the opposite direction of how they're going right now. Are there, I guess, tangible solutions to this?
So I think the solutions need to match the breadth of the problem.
Yeah.
Of these solutions, there's no silver bullet solution.
Yeah.
The solutions need to be across a wide variety of sectors, because we need to be encouraging fathers to be involved with their children. We need to be preparing our boys to become good citizens and good men, and emphasizing the importance of fatherhood and marriage for actually providing them purpose. Mm-hmm. And so it's both of all of these things together. And I'll offer a few tangible solutions. So one is what we talked about. We need to get right about what the purpose of marriage is in our culture, that it's not just about romance. Romance is important, but that's not the only aspect of marriage. And providing a positive view of marriage of this will give you purpose. This will make you happy. There are all these wonderful benefits of marriage. And Brad Wilcox has done a really good job of focusing on that in his new book, Get Married. The second one is, I would say, school choice. So part of the issue with boys is that our education system is not entirely set up for them. Mm-hmm. So boys can have a great deal of energy. They can sometimes be aggressive. They need to move, as do girls. These are not good for girls either. But our school system, where you sit in a desk for 9 hours, has proven really detrimental for boys.
Yeah.
Boys tend to need structure, they need discipline, they need competition. And we have this progressive model of education where we tell children that they are to determine their education. Mm-hmm. And that has proven particularly bad for boys. So school choice is a good way out of that for parents to be able to say, this is a good school for my particular child, and this is a good environment for my boy.
Yeah.
So that's a good solution. I think promoting and getting back to the narrative that there's not one single track in life for success, mm-hmm. which is to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
College is right for some people, but it's not right for everybody. And we promote that as the only way to succeed.
Yeah.
And for example, we promote that in our narrative and also in our policies. So according to Brad Wilcox, the Department of Education spends 79 times more money on colleges and universities than vocational education in high schools and community college.
Mm.
So there's one track, which is to go to college. And the people who have particularly fallen behind in our economy tend to be men without much education.
Mm.
These are the men who would prefer to work in a physical way rather than working in an office.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not preparing them to do that. And the opportunities for that have also declined with the hollowing out of manufacturing and free trade. Mm-hmm. So that's a difficulty we have to match. And then the fourth I would provide is that we really need to get back to embodied interactions in our entire culture. Get away from the screens, limit screen time. Online pornography, video games are unfortunately part of this crisis and what's helping boys, and I mean boys, not just men, because on average, boys are being exposed to pornography at the age of 9.
Mm.
So we really are talking about boys. So get back to embodied interaction, get back to free play, to recess, to those sorts of things. Get away from online dating apps if we want to form, we've talked about this before, if we want to form good and healthy relationships,
mm-hmm.
and reject this psychological notion that we have in our society.
Yeah, so critical. So there's hope. Well, we have a long journey ahead of us.
We have a lot of work to do, yes.
Well, we're going to leave a link in the show notes to that full report for any of our listeners that want to dive a little bit deeper. It is fascinating. And I think as problematic women, we can all be a part of the solution, both aiming in our own lives to seek out and to have, whether you're married or you want to be married one day, but to have a strong marriage. And then also to ask yourself, okay, what does it look like to raise strong kids? And if I have boys, you know, maybe I am looking at, okay, I'm not going to put them in a traditional school where they're sitting at a desk all day, but maybe I look into homeschools or Montessori schools, and again, mm-hmm. pulling on the school choice. And so anyway, we can all be a part of the solution. I think it's going to take a full generation saying yes.
Absolutely. We women have to be part of this,
mm-hmm.
of meeting this solution, because the sexes are totally interdependent.
Yeah.
We need to stop that narrative.
Yep,
exactly. We belong to each other.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Powerful. All right, well, check out the show notes for that. Up next, ED Magazine has categorized female attractiveness into four buckets. We're going to discuss that. But first, the Network of Enlightened Women sees the challenges that conservative women are up against on their college campuses. From liberal professors to finding friends on campus, it can be a lonely place to be as a conservative woman. And that is what inspired the Network of Enlightened Women's president, Karen Lipps, to write You're Not Alone, The Conservative Women's Guide to College. In the book, readers will get to know more than 20 college students and alumni's stories of their real experiences and the advice that they offer on how they have either made it through or are dealing with the challenges on a liberal college campus. And with these stories, Lipps identifies problems on campus and provides just some practical tips for conservative women and how you can thrive. This college guide covers the many real life struggles and hard situations that you face whether you're a freshman or a senior in college. You're Not Alone, The Conservative Women's Guide to College is available for purchase right now on Amazon. Make sure to check it out. You can also visit the Network of Enlightened Women website. That's enlightenedwomen.org. to order the book or just to learn more and find out if you can get involved, maybe if your college has a chapter or how you can start a chapter of this organization. Again, the website is enlightenedwomen.org. ED Magazine recently published an article titled, According to Men, There Are Four Categories of Female Attractiveness. Which one are you? So what they did is that they say women can more or less fall into one of these four categories of being 1, gorgeous, 2, beautiful, 3, hot, or 4, pretty. And they ask men to kind of describe or say, okay, what are the distinguishing characteristics of these four categories of quote unquote attractiveness? So with gorgeous, they use terms and ascribe terms. They say men ascribe terms like there's a stunning element, there's mysterious allure, there's something striking. With beautiful, it's like a timeless appeal, enduring elegance, an emphasis on grace, on balanced features. With hot, that's more sexual, more seductive. There's something bold, there's something captivating about a woman's beauty, maybe like large lips or large eyes. And with pretty, they categorize that as a sweet demeanor, bright smile, warmth, friendliness, the kind of beauty they say that feels both familiar and comforting. So I think articles like this are fascinating, and I found myself in this trap because I read the headline and I was like, ooh, I gotta read that. I gotta click on it. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is so clickbaity. But that's why in the news world, that's why people write this, because they know people are gonna click with a headline like that. But it got me thinking, why as a society are we so pulled in by that question of what is beauty and am I beautiful? Like, why is that something that it's almost innate in human nature? Of like, I want to know what beauty is and I want to know if I fit in that category. And so I think, you know, the question to ask is, why are we so obsessed in our culture with defining beauty? Brenda, I want to get your thoughts on that.
Oh, I'm going to give, I think, a serious answer and then a not so serious answer. So one answer is beauty is an inlet to truth, the good, the true, and the beautiful. And beauty is actually, Bishop Barron describes it as this, one of the smoothest. It's one of the least aggressive inlets to truth because you can see it and you automatically know when something is beautiful, and it inspires awe in you, especially when you encountered beauty in nature. Mm-hmm. So there is something very serious and substantive to beauty. The kind of coming down from that is another answer is that it's social media and we've become obsessed, particularly as women, with comparing ourselves to models in an unhealthy manner. Like Instagram and TikTok are probably the worst when it comes to this. And actually, Jonathan Haidt, his new book, I think, comes out today talking about how this causes anxiety, particular in teenage girls. He's done a lot of work on this, of social media, because it's very image heavy. It really disrupts young girls. And we're seeing things like now 20-year-olds are having Botox parties and having getting Botox, right? And I think part of the narrative of like why women are so insecure when they get pregnant is because it's a sacrifice of your looks. Mm-hmm. And they feel very insecure about that, which is fair enough. I mean, it probably is very challenging.
Yeah.
But we've now almost caricatured beauty of like you see, particularly with Gen Z, this portrait of beauty that is almost plastic, mm-hmm. because there's so much Botox. There's like the fillers, the I don't know what all the things are.
Yeah. But yeah. I don't know either.
Yeah. You look at a woman in her 20s and it doesn't look natural anymore.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes I have to remind myself, and it is actually a very helpful tool to remind myself whether it's seeing someone on Instagram or in magazines. I sound old saying magazines. Do young people still read magazines? Maybe. I don't know.
I don't know what young people do.
In the grocery store, at least when you check out, you see the magazines. You know, you look at these people and it's like, okay, for many people who are held up as this is what beauty is, that's actually their full-time job. To look mm-hmm. good. They're at a position, they're at a level, whether it's model, actor, singer, that part of their job, quote unquote, requirement is to make sure that they are looking good. And that usually comes with financial resources to help them make sure that they are looking good. So it's like it can be a helpful, like fleshy reminder of like, okay, it's okay. They actually like have a lot of time in their day to go to the gym and like do all these things.
Yes, this is so
true. They don't live in the real world of like 9-to-5 work and all the craziness. But, you know, I was thinking about this question, and we were talking a little bit before the show, Brenda, about the fact that like the definition of beauty has changed so much over the years. And, you know, you go back to like the 1700s and people looked at beauty as a woman specifically was very pale and a little chunky. She had some flesh on her. And that was because it was thought that a woman that was a little heavier set and pale, she didn't have to do physical labor outside. Mm-hmm. And she had the time and the luxury of being able to sit inside and eat. And so that was the definition of beauty. And obviously today it's the exact opposite. You're tan and you're very, very thin. And so it changes so much. And it made me think about, okay, what are the times in my life when I have felt most beautiful? And also, what are the times in my life when I have felt the strongest? And I was like, is that the same thing? Are beauty and strength interconnected? And I would say in a way, yes. Like you think about times when you've just felt very strong and very kind of full in who you are. And like I'm
confident.
Very confident. And there is a level of beauty where even like I think about it on hiking trips, right? Where physically you probably don't like look great. You know, your hair is in a bun and you're sweaty, but there's this like inner strength that's being formed. And then, you know, you also think about times of, you know, dressing up and going out to a gala or whatever. And that's when you're like physically like, oh, I look great and I feel good inside. But it's like maybe for slightly different reasons. But I do feel like there's this interesting connection that we sometimes miss, that beauty and confidence are very interconnected.
Mm-hmm. That there's, and you're just grateful for your health. You've
yeah.
had those moments
yeah.
of just being grateful for your body and feeling very in tune with your body, which is a wonderful thing. I've certainly have those moments and I'm really grateful for them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is true that beauty is a bit complicated in that it is objective mm-hmm. and somewhat subjective.
Yeah,
there's symmetry is beautiful. All these things, we can measure those things. But it is also somewhat a matter of preference of mm-hmm. people have a type.
Yeah.
Right? That some people,
so
you know,
true.
You talk about brunettes versus blondes and those sorts of things. People have a personal type. We're actually tend not to be, which is a good thing. We tend not to be attracted to people whose genes are too similar to ours.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So you could look at someone who's like objectively beautiful and then ask a particular individual, do you find this person attractive? And they may say no, because for personally, that is not their match.
Yeah.
Right. So there's both of these things going on simultaneously. But I think what we were talking about with beauty in the past and also what this article is somewhat highlighting is that men find women beautiful for all sorts of reasons, which I think is actually really wonderful.
It is really wonderful.
It is, yeah. And we don't teach young women that much, that message anymore, I think. And it causes some issues with them of whether it's your smile, your eyes. All men find women beautiful for all sorts of reasons, and there's not one particular model. And we've seen this become really troublesome with the transgender movement, I would say, of Chloe Cole, who's a detransitioner and started a organization for detransitioners, said that one of the things that caused her anxiety and insecurity was the image of Kim Kardashian and realizing that she herself personally was not going to have that body type.
Yeah.
And therefore she was lesser as a woman, and maybe she should then just be a boy, which is so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Right. That's just not true.
It's not.
And so I think we do need to be better about telling young girls that men will find you beautiful for many different reasons. Mm-hmm. And part of it is your physical beauty, and part of it is how your character interacts with your beauty.
Yeah.
Like, confidence is a very good example of that, of we find confident people attractive. And that's not just something that's physical. That's something of your personality, your character is coming out through your physical body.
Yeah. I want to mention one practical tool, because I'm a very practical person. I'm like, give me the physical application of how can I work on this? But one tool that I have used to kind of grow this muscle of both confidence and being comfortable in my own skin is in various seasons when I'm just struggling with a characteristic, whether it's I'm struggling with something physical that I'm not loving in the moment about myself, or struggling in some aspect of not walking in full confidence in an area. I just make a list of those areas, and then I write the opposite, and I just speak those things over myself. So, you know, if you're struggling, you know, with feeling like you're not intelligent, declaring, you know, I am intelligent, the Lord has given me a great mind. Or, you know, if you're struggling with insecurity over, you know, something like your legs being too long, right? You know, I have great long legs. You know, it could be anything.
There's no such thing.
I really like my legs. you know, I think there's a lot of power in our words. And when you're willing and you are saying over yourself, No. This is the truth. Yes, other people's words are incredibly powerful that they speak over us. But I think the most powerful voice in our life is our own voice. And that inner critic that we all have, training yourself to stop the critic and say, no, this is the truth. And even if you don't believe it when you first do it, it can just be such a helpful practice. Just make that list and just make a habit. If every morning when you wake up, just read over the list again. When you start, you probably won't mean it, but it starts to actually sink in the more you declare truth over yourself. So, practical tip that's been helpful for me. But stay with us. Up next, we're joined by Sarah Parshall Perry to talk about the Mifepristone case. Are you looking for an easy and entertaining way to keep up with the news you care about? The Daily Signal and Heritage Foundation YouTube channels offer interviews with policy experts on the most critical issues and debates America is facing today, as well as short explainer videos that break down complex issues and documentaries that dive deep into the ways policy actually impacts people. Go ahead and subscribe to both the Daily Signal and Heritage Foundation YouTube channels today. You can search for either on your YouTube app or visit youtube.com/Heritage Foundation and youtube.com/Daily Signal. Well, on Tuesday, hundreds of people were standing outside the Supreme Court using their First Amendment right to protest either for or against the abortion pill. The 9 Supreme Court justices inside were hearing arguments in the case that we've discussed several times on this show. We've talked about Mifepristone, the abortion pill. So I want to give you just a little bit of background on this situation. You'll remember we have said on the show before, so last year there was a judge in Texas that ruled that the Food and Drug Administration was wrong to approve the abortion pill Mifepristone. That pill is part of a 2-pill regimen in order to complete an abortion. Now, in the year 2000, the Food and Drug Administration approved the use of the drug called mifepristone and along with another medication in order to terminate pregnancy. But medical experts said that that approval process was rushed and that the drug is dangerous for women. So last year, there were a group of doctors and organizations that filed a lawsuit against the FDA over the approval of the chemical abortion drug. Now, the judge in Texas, he or she agreed. I'm actually not sure.
He agreed.
And then Biden's Justice Department appealed that Texas ruling. And the DOJ, the Department of Justice, argues that the lawsuit was null and void from the start, since that medical professionals and organizations that filed the lawsuit were not necessarily harmed themselves by the abortion pill. So, long story short, the Supreme Court got involved. They heard arguments on Tuesday. Sarah Parshall Perry is in studio with us now. She was at the court. She spoke at the court. She listened to the arguments. She's been doing interviews nonstop on this case. I feel like she jogged.
She is very tired.
All the way from Baltimore to be able to be with us this morning. Sarah, give me the background. Did I get that rundown right? Is that a pretty good assessment of where we stand?
Yeah. And one of the issues that was not taken up by the court, but it was addressed by Judge Kaczmarek, who was in the Northern District of Texas. He was the one who originally got a hold of the lawsuit. It was in his court. He was the one who decided that the original pill itself, that approval, was illegal. Because as you remember, it was fast-tracked. They used what's called an emergency authorization subpart H mechanism. That's from the Pure Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. They had to classify pregnancy as a serious or life-threatening illness to get it rubber-stamped during the Clinton administration. Well, that, the Fifth Circuit decided, that was the appellate court, listen, guys, you're time-barred, the statute of limitations has run on this, but we will take a look at the 2016 and 2021 decisions to loosen access, and that's expanding the use from 7 weeks to 10 weeks gestation. That is making these pills available by mail. That is making these pills distributable after one telehealth visit. They never see a doctor in office, so no ultrasounds are performed, no exams are performed. No pregnancy exams are performed. So simple questions, and then you get the pills in the mail, which P.S. is barred under federal law. That's a separate issue that came up during oral arguments. But we were only looking yesterday at the 2016 and 2021 decisions.
Got it.
And what the justices are going to have to parse is whether or not the work that these doctors are doing in the emergency room, all of whom are pro-life physicians, and they've been directly impacted by women who've taken the abortion pill, who are post-abortive or are in the middle of an incomplete abortion, or they are suffering from hemorrhage or ectopic pregnancy. 12 instances specifically for one of the doctors, Aaron Hawley, argued yesterday, has directly impacted her as a Christian pro-life physician. She doesn't want to take place in any part of this abortion process. Mm-hmm. And what she's arguing is she's seen these women come in after taking the pill and had to actually get them through the rest of this abortion. Mm-hmm. And what the justices are going to look at is, okay, is this a function of the pill's use generally? Mm-hmm. Meaning simply because it's on the market, and that's not at issue. That's the 2000 decision. Or is this a direct result from the 2016 and 2021 decisions? Can we trace these 12 instances to the loosening of regulations on the actual abortion pill? Justice Kagan called this very probabilistic, meaning, you know, she's having a hard time finding that connection between the FDA's decisions on those two different years, mm-hmm. to connect directly to what these pro-life physicians are experiencing in the emergency room. Justice Sotomayor said, well, listen, these doctors have conscience regulations, right? They have a right to be able to opt out under the Free Exercise Clause. That's part of what are called the Church Amendments. And the Church Amendments guide specifically anyone who is in practice at a medical facility that's in receipt of federal dollars to be able to say, listen, I don't want to engage in this procedure because it's a violation of my belief. Aaron Hawley, obviously arguing for ADF, said specifically, listen, these are emergency situations. These doctors aren't going to go up to the top floor, talk to their general counsel and say, can I exercise my right when they're getting a woman on a stretcher who could be hemorrhaging to death? A lot of these doctors don't know what they're getting until they scrub in the emergency room. So they're bringing this particular claim under specifically the Administrative Procedure Act. That's one federal law that requires all agencies to make reasonable and reasonably explained decisions, not just slapdash. You have to show us the evidence, indicate to us you took all of the considerations into account, and also the Pure Drug and Cosmetic Act, which is what I mentioned earlier. And specifically under that law, they said that the FDA didn't have any evidence that the pill was safe for individuals, minor girls under the age of 18. Well, that's specifically important because we know that that cohort uses the abortion pill more than surgical abortions overall. Surgical abortions actually account for less than abortions here in America. 63% are now done by the abortion pill. So the interest in making this safer and more regulated is really for, or it should be, I should say, both sides of the argument, whether you're pro-life or you're pro-abortion. And to see sort of some of the hysteria outside with the protesters yesterday at the court, you'd be hard-pressed to believe that this was really a case about drug safety and not about abortion. But drug safety and the FDA's regulatory power, that is really at bottom what the case is about.
And what were you able to infer from the kinds of questions that the justices were asking? I know that you are one of the few lawyers that's willing to make bets about how they might
rule. Don't tell John Malcolm. I know. You know, this is, Virginia, I think this is really anybody's game at this point. Okay. I will say Kavanaugh was very quiet, surprisingly quiet. Sotomayor and Kagan talked about the rights of conscience. Why didn't you just opt out, right? If you had to do these 12 procedures, why didn't you just opt out? We know how Aaron Hawley, arguing for ADF, responded. I will say Justice Gorsuch seemed a little queasy about the nature of this nationwide injunction. In other words, he was not necessarily a fan of the concept of rolling back 2021 and 2016 decisions because he said, listen, the lower courts dabble in these big nationwide injunctions. But we, as a general rule, try to stay away from that kind of equitable relief. It's available, yes, but that's sort of a last resort for us. But I will say Justices Thomas and Alito really put Elizabeth Prelogar, who is the U.S. Solicitor General, arguing for the Department of Justice, to some very hard questions. So I got to tell you, I think this is going to be one of those maybe surprise upsets. It could be a very close decision in the end. I'm thinking sort of a 5-4. Barrett, I think, is leaning with the more conservative justices, but the procedural mechanisms to me seemed to be really 90% of the argument. Do these doctors have standing? Okay. Can they trace these 12 procedures, what happened in the emergency rooms, to what happened with the FDA in 2016 and 2021? Or is it just that the abortion pill was used at all? And that's what they have to prove.
Okay. Wow. Sarah, thank you, not just for breaking this down today, but literally since this really all started popping up over a year ago, right?
Yeah.
So we really appreciate it. Thanks for running in between media hits and joining us here on Problematic Women.
Well, I am happy to do it. And remember, we have another case that's coming up on the Emergency Medicine Treatment and Labor Act. And that, too, is going to be one more time that abortion's on the docket. So
we'll talk to you then as well. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Stay tuned because up next, we crown our Problematic Woman of the Week. Five days a week, two episode formats, one mission: to deliver the news you care about and analysis on the biggest issues facing America. The Daily Signal podcast brings you two episodes every day in the same podcast feed. Each morning, catch interviews with policymakers, leading experts, and conservative activists as we discuss some of the greatest challenges facing our country and offer solutions for a brighter future. And every weekday at 5 p.m., we bring you the top news of the day. These are the headlines you care about. Subscribe to the Daily Signal podcast wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss out on our morning interviews or evening news.
now it is that time once again, my favorite time of the week, time to crown our problematic woman of the week. And the crown goes to
Caitlin Clark.
Caitlin Clark is an NCAA Division I basketball player for the University of Iowa. And right now, she is setting records during the March Madness basketball season.
Yes, the season. I can tell you're an avid basketball fan, Brenda. Well, yeah, in full disclosure, I am not a basketball fan, but this has been fun to watch. So Caitlin Clark, Brenda, like you said, she is a Division I basketball player out of the University of Iowa, and she has just really in many ways been, I think, the first female player in a little while that's actually really capturing national attention. And USA Today actually reports that ticket sales have reached all-time record highs because of her playing, which is really, really neat to see. And there was a big kind of upset with her team and West Virginia's. And so it's for all of our basketball fans out there, I think it's really fun to see that, you know, and obviously this gets into a whole other conversation about professional men's versus women's sports and all of that. But it's fun to see a female basketball player that is getting such great press and such great attention and who's a leader on her team. And so for all of our basketball fans out there, we hope that you are enjoying March Madness. And if you haven't looked up Caitlin Clark, she is a fun story to follow. So be following her in the coming days and weeks as she hopefully continues to achieve greatness in the basketball world. But with that, that is going to do it for this week's edition of Problematic Women.
Join us next Thursday morning for a brand new edition. And in the meantime, please subscribe and share.
Conservatives need your support in the podcast world. So we would greatly appreciate a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, Google Play, wherever you like to listen. We are across all podcast platforms, and it really does make a huge difference.
Have a great week.
And happy Easter. Enjoy
happy
your Easter.
Easter.
Problematic Women is brought to you by more than 500,000 members of the Heritage Foundation.
It is a product of the Daily Signal, produced by Lauren Evans and Virginia Allen. And be sure to follow Problematic Women on Instagram.
We produce Problematic Women in remembrance of our dear friend and former co-host, Bree Payton.